Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin, Mishkin Law in Chicago. And we've got a great show today. We've got a wonderful Grateful Dead show that we're featuring. And if you can hear it in my voice, so far I've survived the first two nights of Alpine Valley. Night three of Fish is this evening. This show comes out tomorrow, so unfortunately I couldn't also get to the third show. But we'll be talking about nights one and two, and those were fantastic and lots to talk about. Some interesting stuff on the pro and the negative side of marijuana. We always try to find a little bit of both and other great stuff. So thank you for joining us today, and you're going to really enjoy it. We're featuring the Grateful Dead from 30 years ago today, July 29th, 1994, at Buckeye Lake, Ohio. It's kind of a funky venue in Ohio. I was never there, but my good friends John and Marnie went a couple of times, and they really loved it. We just never made it out there. But this was the show 30 years ago, and the Dead was in a rare frame of mind that night. Here's what they opened with. That is Rain. That is the Beatles. One of their well-known songs, Rain. They came out that night and just decided they were going to have a lot of fun with everybody. And there it was. John Lennon wrote most of the song. It was the first song to get really deep, exploring the themes of reality and illusion for him. After all, rain or shine is just a state of mind, as he liked to say. John said he wrote the song about people moaning about the weather all the time as he was becoming more in tune with his role as a social leader, as is evidenced by the lines "I Can Show You" and "Can You Hear Me?" This was the first song to use a tape played backwards, which created the strange audio effect. John discovered the technique when he put the tape for Tomorrow Never Knows on backwards. He was stoned at the time, and the producer, George Martin, had to convince him that using a backward recording for the entire song was a bad idea. Wayne was mixed for mono on April 16th, 1966, following an uninterrupted 11-hour overdub and mixed-down session. Singles were not issued in stereo at that time, and the song did not appear on any album. So no stereo mix was made until December 2nd, 1969, when the song was ready to be included on the U.S. compilation of the LP Hey Jude, which was kind of an album that came out at the end and just picked up a bunch of these types of songs that had been played by the Beatles, but hadn't been recorded in any one particular place yet. When it came out as a single on May 30th, 1966, it was the B-side to the A-side Paperback Writer, another memorable Beatles tune from that era. So, one that didn't quite make the albums, came out as a good single, so not unlike, some Grateful Dead songs in that regard. But this was just another one, that as they went farther along into the late 80s and then well into the 90s there, they loved the Beatles, and they played the Beatles a lot. If you ever read the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, there is a a whole section in there where they talk about how Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and some of the guys from the Dead all went to see the Beatles when they came to San Francisco, I think in 1966. And, you know, the Beatles were this big, huge pop thing. And so they all felt like they had to go see them. And it's very interesting to hear different people in the group talk about the Beatles. A lot of the Merry Pranksters were kind of flat about it because, you know, the Beatles were just came out and basically ripped through their songs the way they sounded on the album. And the concert was about an hour. You know, they kind of questioned it, but, some of the guys in the Dead and, Kesey, you know, was the Beatles for them. It was like this whole big cultural thing as you know, as music moved along. Either way, it's well known that they were big fans of the Beatles. They play the Beatles a lot. In fact, we're going to hear another Beatles song in this concert, which I don't recall the Dead doing very often, if at all. But meanwhile, as far as Rain is concerned, the band played it 29 times. It was first played on December 2nd, 1992 at the McNichol Sports Arena in Denver, Colorado. And it was last played on June 3rd, 1995 at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh. So they liked it, you know, and over the last 3 years, they got it in just about 10 times a year there. We heard it a couple of times. It was always fun. You know, the singing isn't Beatles-esque, but, you know, I give Jerry credit for doing it. You know, and I think a big part of this push with the Beatles, too, a lot of the credit for that has to go to Vince Welnick, because he was also the force behind Bob O'Reilly into Tomorrow Never Knows and some other songs. And you can hear him singing along with Jerry in that show on this tune and, you know, just having a great time. And I think that that's fun for these guys. You know, they reach a point in their career where sure they have all their songs, but it's kind of fun to play, you know, rock and roll oldies and, you know, gold like the Beatles, anything they touched. Right. And so it's a nice effect for the fans. Everybody comes in typically expecting, you know, any of your standard openers and, instead, you get Rain and you're treated to something pretty amazing, and that's a lot of fun. Now, being the Dead, they immediately followed out of Rain into Feel Like a Stranger, which, of course, is another opener, and then they followed straight from that into Bertha, which is yet another opener, and they followed from that into the tune we're going to play in a second, but these are just all openers, and they just threw them all out there. Maybe they couldn't decide which one they wanted to play. So they said, we're going to have a little bit of fun with all of them. But I remember talking to good friends, John and Marty, about the show afterwards, and they really loved it. And Buckeye Lake was just an interesting place, just a big, huge field. And they'd come out there and they'd play. And 1 year it rained and 1 year it was really hot. But, you know, it was summer and we were young and we didn't care. We were seeing the Grateful Dead and everybody really enjoyed it. And the band clearly enjoyed it, too. And they were definitely having a good time with all of this. So I feel like we've been featuring Bertha a lot lately. Feel Like a Stranger, we've talked about a few times. So it's nice to get the Rain in there. But then, as I say, the fourth tune of the show was also another song that I've seen them open with many a time and is really a lot of fun. And let's listen to that. Thank you. Wang Dang Doodle. We featured the song on the show before. It's a blues song written by Willie Dixon. Music critic Mike Rowe calls it a party song in an urban style with its massive, rolling, exciting beat. It was first recorded by Howlin' Wolf in 1960 and released by Chess Records in 1961. In 65, Dixon and Leonard Chess persuaded Coco Taylor to record it for Checker Records, a Chess subsidiary. Taylor's rendition quickly became a hit, reaching number 13 on the Billboard R&B chart and number 58 on the pop chart. Wang Dang Doodle became a blues standard and has been recorded by various artists. Taylor's version was added to the United States National Recording Registry in 2023. In 1995, Taylor's rendition was inducted into the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame in the Classics of Blues Recording, Singles or Albums Tracks category. The foundation noted that the song was the last blues single produced by Dixon to reach the record charts and became Coco Taylor's signature crowd pleaser, inspiring sing-alongs to the all-night-long refrain, Night After Night. Taylor's version of Wang Dang Doodle was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Recording Registry in 2023. Now, just as a quick aside, Coco Taylor was a regular at Chicago's blues clubs, and our group saw her a couple of times at some of the blues clubs, mostly on the north side of the city, but in other locales as well. And when she would belt out Wang Dang Doodle, it was just great. And I had heard her sing it before I heard the Dead sing it. When the Dead sang it too, it's a very cool combination of all these different elements coming together at a Grateful Dead show. Now, interestingly, Chuck Berry, Bruce Hornsby, John Popper, a blues traveler, Bob Weir, and Willie Dixon's daughter, Shirley Dixon, performed Wang Dang Doodle in tribute to Willie Dixon at the 1994 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony. In his autobiography, I Am the Blues, Willie Dixon says, Wang Dang Doodle meant a good time, especially if the guy came in from the South. The Wang Dang men having a ball and a lot of dancing. They called it a rocket style so hard, that's what it's meant to Wang Dang Doodle. Wang Dang Doodle was first performed by the Grateful Dead on August 26, 1983 at the Portland Memorial Coliseum in Portland, Oregon. The song was only played a few times each year through the rest of the 80s. From 91 onwards, it was performed more often, averaging about 15 performances of a year through 1995. In total, the Dead played it 95 times, as we said, first on August 26, 83. And the last time they played it was July 8th, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago. So right up until the very end. And that was not uncommon. It was a song that we would frequently hear in Chicago, as the boys played tribute to the Chicago blues scene. And it was always a lot of fun, a real crowd pleaser, and a great way to start a concert. Or sometimes it would show up kind of earlier in the first set. In our show today, it's the fourth song, kind of jokingly, the fourth opener of the first four songs they played, since they all kind of have that groove. You get somebody like Coco Taylor, you get somebody like Jerry. We already know that the Dead love to cover Willie Dixon tunes. We talked about that a lot last week as well. And this is just another example. And just a lot of fun. It shows the depth and the range of the Grateful Dead as musicians, as singers, music aficionados. We've talked about how so much of their musical repertoire is just as a foundation of these early songs by early black singers, by early white singers, by early every kind of singers and musicians. And they were such fans of it all that, they kind of pulled it together in their own unique way. And that's what we call the Grateful Dead. So this was very, very cool. Great tune to hear, a lot of fun. And they're just rocking along with it. Now, we are going to take a brief moment here, not so brief because we got a lot to talk about, and we're going to shift our way over to music news and what's going on with that. So, Dan, why don't you lead us into our musical segment? Rock and Roll Fantasy. Boy, once again, Dan Picking Out the Tunes, It Takes Me Back to High School Days, sung by British rock band Bad Company. It was written by vocalist Paul Rodgers and released as the first single from the group's 1979 studio album, Desolation Angels. I've got that laying around somewhere. It was one of Bad Company's best-known songs and has become a staple of classic rock radio. Yeah, when that came out, we had all heard of Bad Company, and it was just, it's a fun tune, you know, nice poppy, catchy tune, got some good hooks in it, and, you know, got a ton of airplay on FM radio, certainly in St. Louis, and I'm guessing in a lot of other places. It was inspired by a guitar synthesizer riff that Paul Rodgers had come up with. While not the band's highest charting single in America, it is their best-selling, having been certified gold in the United States. Bad Company was an English rock supergroup, was formed in London in 1973 by singer Paul Rodgers, drummer Simon Kirk, both formerly of the band Free, guitarist Mick Ralphs, formerly of Mott the Hoople, and bassist Boz Burrell, formerly of King Crimson. Kirk was the only member to remain throughout the band's entire run, while he and Ralphs were the only members to appear on every studio album. Peter Grant, who managed the rock band Led Zeppelin, also managed Bad Company until 1992. So this is a band that was just known for great music. You can still hear a lot of their music today. And another very appropriate and fun choice for us by Dan. So thank you for that. Okay, let's roll into music news. And when I say music news, what I really mean is fish, because I've just been submerged in two nights, four sets, a couple of encores, and just some outstanding music with a ton of shows still to go. And that's, you know, it's like when you're on your first day of vacation, you stop and you realize, boy, I had such a great time today. And it's only the first day of vacation. You know, the last two nights, I've been kind of struck by the end of both nights thinking, boy, these were both fantastic shows. I've got another show tonight in St. Louis coming up this week, and then eventually Mondegreen in Dover, Delaware in August. And that's just going to be just a good summer of fish. And, you know, I don't know if I'll ever do it again or ever be able to do it again, but I'm doing it right now. And it's just great. So let's touch base, Alpine Valley. And first of all, let me just say how cool it is to continue to go back to Alpine Valley. Such a venue where, during my formative years of the Grateful Dead, where from 84 through 89, there was always a summer journey up to Alpine Valley. '84, they played two shows. After that, it was three shows every year, except for '88 when they played four shows. They loved it. The fans loved it. It's just a beautiful venue up in a very picturesque area of Wisconsin with rolling hills and green. And you can kind of see the Foss ski slope in the background, where people other than like Dan Humiston or Rob Hunt, who would never be caught dead skiing at a place like Alpine Valley. But for the rest of us Midwesterners, you know, that's where we have to go to capture our skiing thrills when, Colorado or California or some of those other places, Tahoe, just aren't in the offing. That's where we go to get in our quote unquote skiing. But for us, it's just been a wonderful place of so many happy memories, seeing so many great shows there. And it's wonderful to be going back still and seeing fish, and more importantly, seeing it with my boys. My son Jonathan and I went the first two nights, and we just really had a great time doing that. Last night, Jonathan and I went again, and we spent a lot of time up on the lawn because my oldest son Matthew was in town visiting his good buddy Jason, who's in from Israel for a few weeks. And Jason's a huge fish fan, having originally come from the United States but moved to Israel many years back, but still keeping in touch with all of the great music. And he's a huge fan. Our good buddy Z-Dub, Seth, was there. Z-Dub was there. Seth was there, which means if he's there, he's not in my house stealing my dilly bars out of my freezer, which is okay. Max from New York, Danielle and Josh were there. And Josh Steinberg from Indiana. Loves him because he's a big Cardinal fan. And these are all guys who I've known most of them forever because they were all good buddies with my son growing up. Some of them live right down the street in the neighborhood. Some of them we become really good friends with their parents. Max is the outlier in that he's from New York, but through the whole fish crowd, we've gotten to know Max very well. too. He was at Matthew's wedding, which was a lot of fun. And it was great to get to hang out with all of these guys at a show and really kind of take it in from their perspective, you know. And what I found is it's not that much different from the way my buddies and I were when we were all trekking out to Alpine to see the Dead show after show and have a great time with it. And so it was very nice to get to be with all of those guys. A few of the guys in that group are going to be joining at Mondegreen, and that's going to be excellent. And so really, really excited about all of it. So let's talk about these shows for a minute. So the Friday night show, Friday night, first show of a 3-night run, everybody's there. You kind of, you know, a lot of energy in the crowd waiting to see what's going to happen. Boys came out pretty much just a few minutes after 7:30. They've been very consistent in their starting times, about an hour and a half after the doors open. And, they walked right out, plugged in, and just started playing. Took everybody off with a 46 Days, which is a fun tune. One of those songs that I'm familiar with, not one that was necessarily at the top of my list of songs I wanted to hear, but just well played, about 10 minutes, and they really cranked on it. And then they went into MoMA Dance, which I do happen to like a lot, and I love the whole Mondegreen-esque aspect of that, right? Are they saying The Moment Ends or MoMA Dance? And if you listen very carefully, sometimes you just can't tell. Then they played The Well, which is a song that I was not particularly familiar with, but very well played. And to My Friend, a song that I do know and enjoyed. Brian and Robert, a song that I'm familiar with, but I have to confess I did not recognize while they were playing it. But somebody was kind enough to clue me in, and that was enjoyable. And then they went into Llama, only the second time I think I've ever heard Llama, and it's kind of a funny, frenetic song with, you know, wild lyrics, Llama to boot, whatever all that means, who the hell knows, but they know, or maybe they don't. And that's just fun. From Llama, they went in to Cities, which prompted me to have to pick up the phone and call my good buddy, Alex, who's on, a source of so much good musical knowledge for me, to find out if Fish ever figured out that the Talking Heads were covering their song. That's a little inside joke, because the first time I talked with Alex about playing Cities, he reminded me that it was a Talking Heads song. So, I always like to kind of throw back at him to say, yes, I learned my lesson and I know. It was a great song, though. They play it really, really well. And right when they dive into it, it's just instantly recognizable. In fact, I do immediately recognize it as a Talking Heads song, and it takes me 2 seconds longer to figure out which Talking Heads song it is. But they've got that beat, that sound. They really, really play it well, and it was just a wonderful version of Cities. Inchi Amar, a crowd pleaser, Stash, which I thought was going to be the set closer, and a song I really, really like, and they really jammed through it well. And then they turned a corner and surprised us and dropped in a cavern as well. So we had a first set that was just about an hour and a half, from 7:40 to 9:10. And, what I always like about Fish and the Dead, it's not that I like it, but it fascinates me. They come on stage, they start playing, and before you know it, the set is over. And, they've been up there for an hour and a half, and I just lose all track of time while that's happening, which to me is obviously a credit to them, right? The music is so great. You're so focused on it and just having a wonderful time. It's where there's other bands I've gone to see from time to time. And, not that I'm bored. I certainly enjoy seeing all bands, but if it's in a crowded venue or it's really hot or, they run into a stretch of songs where I'm just not as familiar, sometimes I'll find myself looking at my phone just to see what time it is. And, I will confess there's been some nights where time seemed to just really drag along, but time never drags at a Fish show. Time never drags at a Dead show. They're over much too fast. And, just as you're first getting into the real jam, it feels like they're coming out on the back end and closing it down. And so it was just a wonderful, wonderful first set. And then another factor that's been consistent the first two nights that I just love is the set breaks were only about 30 minutes long. And this was just the same thing. They walked off the stage at 9:06. They were right back out there at 9:35. Jumped into the second set with Axela, a song that I'm familiar with but hadn't heard very much. And very much enjoyed, and then dropped into Down With Disease. And Down With Disease and Bathtub Gin and sometimes Rebar songs that, at least the way I hear them as all being somewhat not similar, but in the same genre, a same type of song, with a lot of really hard jamming, and the Down With Disease did not disappoint. They really cranked out on that, and they were all having a good time. Then they went into Mercury, a song that I recognize from hearing, but don't have any recollection of having seen them play it before. But that was a lot of fun. Taste is great. And then Trey dropped into a Ghost, and Ghost is like one of those songs that I've really, come to know really well. And I kind of like the fact that some of these songs, the minute they drop the first note, everybody around me is screaming. They, oh my God, it's this. There are some Fish songs where I'm good at that, some where I'm not so good at it. Ghost is one where I'm good at it. And it's interesting for me because it doesn't always sound exactly the same when they lead into it. I've heard it like with a few slightly different intros, but yet there's something about the way they're doing it that just says to me they're going into Ghost. And they did. And that was about a 10-minute jam. And, Trey just really tearing it up and having a great time. Then they went into Limb by Limb, followed by Silent in the Morning. And then for the closer of the second set, a song they've been known to play from time to time, but I had not heard them do it yet, Led Zeppelin's Good Times, Bad Times. And I have to say, they nail it. They just play it really, really well. And again, it has a little bit of a Zeppelin-esque sound to it. I'm not going to say that it's Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones and the boys out there cranking it out, but you could be excused for thinking that, you were listening to a different era of Led Zeppelin playing the song, because they just have all the, again, the notes, the solos, the hooks, the everything. These guys, when they cover another band, they do a really good job of it. They don't just throw it out there and say, oh, let's see what happens. So finally, again, about another hour and a half later, right before 11 o'clock, the band walks off the stage. For the encore, they came out and they played Contact, which is a fun song, kind of a silly song, but fun nonetheless. And, just one that they clearly enjoy playing, and Mike Gordon really enjoys, and that was great. And then they didn't disappoint, and they came back with a really, really solid Run Like an Antelope to close out the night. And that itself, was probably about a 10-minute adventure, maybe a little bit longer. And, they were really stretching it out in some points. And it's nice, you see them up there, with the confidence of, look, we're so well known, we've done all this, we can just play this tune the way we want to play it tonight and just kind of jam through it. And, every time you hear a Fish song, it sounds a little bit different than the last time you heard it, which is, not different from the way it was with the Grateful Dead. And certainly one of those things that keeps you going back and going back, because it's fun to hear each time how they decide to play their song, what parts of it they're going to emphasize, what they're going to do. But Run Like an Antelope, and they sent us all out into the night. My son Jonathan and I got in and drove back to his place in the Mundelein area. And I have to say, Waze is a beautiful thing. If you don't have Waze, if you haven't used Waze, if you're one of those people who still think you know how to do it best, get Waze, for God's sakes. I have now driven up and back from Alpine Valley, up twice and back twice for the first two shows, and haven't found any traffic at all. They're taking me through back roads in Wisconsin. Some of them, I don't even have any idea where I'm at. I'm just following Waze and holding on for dear life. But boy, what a treat to, be able to venture from, basically the North Shore of Chicago up to Alpine Valley with just minimal traffic. And I just think back to the days when we were driving up there to see the Grateful Dead. And this was way before there was any Waze or GPS or even, cell phones, basically. And, we all knew you took 94 up to 50, and you took 50 west to Lake Geneva, and then you took 12 north to 45 or whatever the other one is. And then you got off in East Troy and started looking for all the cops all the back roads were there, but nobody really knew them. So everybody went these ways. We'd hit traffic on 94, just getting off of 94 onto 50, and that traffic could back up for half a mile or more sometimes. And then you'd have these long line of cars going down 50, that at some points gets up to 55 miles an hour, but a lot of times drops down to 30 miles an hour with stop signs and lights and all of this. And it could just be a brutal, brutal drive getting there. And even getting back, although the crowd would disperse pretty quickly, there's a lot of people driving back down to the Chicago area. So there was always a lot of cars doing that. You know, with this Waze, man, nothing. And I've used Waze, you know, all sorts of places. I just don't go up to Alpine Valley enough, you know, to really use it, or, you know, in a way where I'm really thinking about it. But I was driving, and it was just amazing. It was just so wonderful to be able to get in, get out, and all of that. And even though they kind of screwed everybody because they sold MVP, VIP parking, which I've decided at this stage of my life, I'm all in on. The advantage is that you get out really quick, but for some reason there was a screw up scheduling with the Alpine Valley Lodge this year. They were not letting cars exit out down the little road that takes you down to the lodge and then zips you right out through the lodge's exit and entrance. And we had to circle back because VIP, you're all the way down to the front and the exit's all the way in the back. But we managed to get out in a reasonable amount of time. Not terrible, not quite as fast as we would have liked, but we were really in no hurry and just kind of hanging out and crowd watching and everything. And got back to Jonathan's place. His good buddy Brendan was there hanging out, watching the dog because Johnny's fiance was out with friends and family for a night or two. And hung out, had some pizza, watched some stupid Family Guy, got stoned a little bit more, and then just all passed out and said it's time to go to bed. And then yesterday was just one of those, like, I'm on tour days because I'm not at home, and get the podcast started to get that ready, try to bounce back and recover because I'm not as young as I used to be. And so, you know, it takes a little bit longer especially in the knees and the hips a little bit, roll them out on one of those rollers, get some China gel. Thanks to good buddy Aaron, the trainer, who turned me onto that years ago, which really makes a difference on those knees for old folk like us, and really a lot of fun. But after all of that, Johnny and I were ready for night two last night. We drove back up there. As I said, my son Matthew was there with his old crowd, and we met up with them on the lawn. And really, at the end of the day, just wound up watching the whole show. And like I say, it was just so much fun to be around that crew and, you know, think back to 30-plus years ago when I was their age and I was out there with all of my buddies. And, you know, we were having all the fun like they're having now. And it's just a wonderful time. You know, they're kind of past the college years. A lot of them are married. Some of them, like Matthew, have kids. And yet, you know, they're still finding the time to all get together. And this was really beautiful because their buddy Jason was in from Israel, visiting family and friends and bringing his daughter and his lovely new son, Rafi, who everybody got to meet. And so people had come into town to see him. And Jason, like I said, is a huge Fish fan. So they were like, oh, we'll just all go see Fish for a night. And just like that, they pulled it all together. They got their tickets. And one thing I'll say that was surprising was that Fish did not sell out either night. In other words, you could walk up to the box office and buy lawn tickets right up to showtime. And that's maybe, a pondering for another day. You know, like, are people, you know, getting exhausted of Fish? Was it because it was an Alpine Valley and people didn't want to drive all the way up there? You know, as opposed to, you know, shows that are more in the city, like at Wrigley Field, or when they play at the United Center or the Rosemont. But I wasn't complaining because it kept the crowd very reasonable in the lawn. Was more than enough room, plenty of room, plenty of elbow room, and you could kind of bounce around on the lawn if you were so inclined. And my son Jonathan had one of those big light sticks that he was twirling around a mile a minute with a little newfound energy. And, you know, everybody was just having a great time, and it was just a wonderful place to be. My only complaint, and this is an old guy complaint, but it's a really, really, really steep hill on the lawn. And, you know, standing there looking downhill, you know, worked the calf muscles really good, but, you know, I'm not going to lie, the feet kept slipping forward in my shoes and I had to keep stopping and, you know, knocking them back because you can only have your resting up on your toes like that for so long. But, wow. You know, those are my complaints. I love the fact that I'm still there at 60 going strong and having a good time seeing it. And, last night was again, well worth it to come back with the boys. They came out and opened with Sample in a Jar, which is a fun tune. I kind of, you know, it's more of a pop tune for them, you know, with a lot more lyrics and a few more musical hooks that then You know, some of their longer, more jammed out tunes, but a very fun tune. And, you know, one that you kind of pick up the words to the more you hear it. So, you know, it's fun. It's energetic. The crowd reacts and, everybody has a great time with it. Although they went into Halley's Comet, and Halley's Comet was definitely one of those Phish songs, that you acquire, it's an acquired taste over time. You know, the first time you hear it and they're just belting out, Halley's Comet, Halley's Comet, hey, about 20 times in a row. And you're trying to figure out, okay, got it, Halley's, what the hell else? And then they dive in and it's a song, that's at the top of the list of just absolutely crazy, nonsensical Phish lyrics. And it makes it fun. And you know, it's part of my development and my growth of Phish that, unlike the Dead, with Phish, the lyrics typically aren't always as significant to your enjoyment of the song. Sometimes they are, certainly with some of the songs. But you know, a song like Halley's Comet, it's the words kind of help make the song and provide a foundation for it, much more than the song being about the particular lyrics. It's just, it's crazy, it's nutty, it's funny. If you're in the right frame of mind, it's even hysterical. But they really love it and they really jam through it. They went into Birds of a Feather, which is a well-played and I don't want to say frequently played song, but certainly, you know, a song that I've seen a couple of times as I now enter into, I tried to sit down and count it the other night. I think I'm getting very close to 20 Phish shows, and it may very well be that by the time I'm done with this run, I'm going to be over 20. In fact, I'd say that's a pretty good guess. It's interesting. I don't have the exact number like I do with the Dead, but I'm a little fuzzy on a couple of years where I can't find ticket stubs, but I thought for sure I was at shows. So I'm still working it out, but someday, hopefully I'll have a solid list of that as I do of my, my 100+ Dead shows, which it seems like I can go down the list and almost tell you each and every one some memory of them, just because that's the impact it had on me. But after Birds of a Feather, they played Mountains in the Mist, a very lovely song, kind of a mellow tune, Into Foam, which was fun. And then doing what they do so well, playing, you know, covers that it's not so unusual anymore to hear them, but it's always fun to hear which of the covers they dive into. And last night we got Moon Age Daydream from David Bowie, and just a wonderful, wonderful song. Of course, Bowie was an amazing performer. We saw him a few times, and he never failed to put on a great show and just entertain. And these guys really have a love of David Bowie. They cover a number of his tunes, and again, while they're playing it, they just have that kind of like background sound to the music that was so Bowie-esque. But it was wonderful. And they came out on the back end of it with this really, really strong 5 to 10 minute jam with Trey just tearing it up, you know, in a way that you can see that he's just clearly enjoying it, having so much fun. The crowd's eating it up. Everybody had a great time with it. Then they dropped into the song My Soul, nice tune, and then into Lizards, which is fun. I like Lizards. It's a Gamehenge tune. It's kind of campy on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's fun. And when they get to the chorus and everything, and everybody starts kind of just bouncing around while they're singing it, and Trey's up on stage bouncing around while he's playing and singing it, and everyone just has a good time. And I've seen it now a couple of times. I saw it for the first time at Alpine a couple of years ago, and got to see it again. And it's fun. And, you know, it's not the same as seeing it the first time, you know, that kind of initial excitement. But it is fun because you get the sense that when they're playing it, they're having a great time on stage, and it really gets the crowd going. And then, because they're Phish and, you know, they're situationally aware, they closed out the set with their song, David Bowie, which is another wonderful jamming tune that just goes on and on and on. And of course, the only lyrics are David Bowie. And then on the second time around, UB40, they both have the same, I guess, syllable sequence. So it fits in very nicely with the way they're singing the song. And it's a great jammer. You know, you can tell that it's going to be a set closer because how much energy they pour into it. And they did not disappoint last night. It was just wonderful. They finally closed it out, and it checked in at just about the set, an hour and 45 minutes. So about 10 minutes shorter than the night before, but so well played that, you know, nobody was really complaining at all. And then again, very consistently, they took just about a 30 minute break. just enough time to run to the bathroom, grab a drink, and get back up on the lawn. And at that point, Johnny and I had decided we were just going to hang out with the boys for the rest of the night, because it had gotten crowded enough. Not, again, necessarily in our area, but navigating your way out of the lawn onto, you know, the pavilion where you could go to buy drinks, and then getting, well, into the that area, then getting down into the seating pavilion was just very crowded and not an area you wanted to walk through multiple times if you didn't have to. And we were all having a great time. And they came out, like I say, half an hour later, dived into Sigma Oasis, which is a tune that I'm just really learning. A little controversial because it has the line about take off your mask. And when they first played it a couple of years ago, right on the tail end of the pandemic, there were people who were masking at Fish shows that didn't like the fact that they were playing a song that seemed to suggest that Fish was anti-masking. I don't think that that was their intent. And now when they sing it, nobody really thinks about it because nobody's masking these days, even though COVID is still out there, as I know, because I just had it a couple of weeks ago. But nevertheless, it was a fun tune. But here's the thing about The Simple, and this is what really makes Fish, I think, very unique. The song itself is anywhere from about 7 to 10 minutes. And the other times when I've seen it, it's played 7 to 10 minutes. Maybe sometimes they kick it out to 15 minutes. Well, folks, last night we were treated to a 41-minute simple. They came out, they opened with Sigma Oasis at 9:10. They played it just for about 5 to 7 minutes, and then they dived into Simple. And, you know, the opening part of it, the lyrics and everything all sounded very normal. And then they started jamming, which all sounded very normal. And then I realized that they were still kind of jamming and okay. And then a little bit more. And then, you know, we headed into the Type 2 jam where, you know, from the Deadhead world, you got a Type 2 jam was when you forget the song that they're playing in the middle of the jam. And I found myself pulling out my phone a couple of times to make sure that I hadn't missed something and that they were still in Simple. There gets to be a point in a jam like this, I think, where the crowd catches on and realizes that, you know, they're really jamming this one out much farther down the road than they normally do. And what I like about Fish is that they will do this periodically and they will do it with different songs. Sure, they have some songs that you know are going to be, you know, really long jams and really hang out there, although typically not 41 minutes. But Simple was a, you know, just not a song I would have pegged at the time for them to jam out so long on. So in that respect, it was a little bit surprising for me. But by the same token, I got to be in this situation where you kind of recognize, wow, okay, now you say, let's see how far they're going to take this. And, you know, again, you kind of slip back into the groove and just going on and on and on. And then you stop for a second, you're like, nope, still Simple. Nope, still Simple. And like I say, it clocked in just somewhere around 41, 42 minutes in length. And you know, that's great. It's kind of hard to, you know, come up with a direct dead comparison. But, you know, I guess you could say, imagine if they took a tune like West L.A. Fade Away, which is a great tune and has, you know, some extended jams on there. But if they took that song and played it out 41 minutes, you know, if it's playing in the band, you're like, yeah, sure, Dark Star. Well, of course, they're going to play it out that long, you know, or they could play it out that long. Right. Not that they always did, but it certainly wouldn't be a surprise. You know, but Brown Eyed Woman, if all of a sudden they took Brown Eyed Woman and they just, you know, back ended, jammed it out for that long. And then, you know, very, you know, quickly at the very end, dive back in to sing the final chorus one last time. I think that would really catch Deadheads off guard because there were some songs that we just never anticipated or expected to be jammed out. We just always assumed those were the shorter songs, the kind of sing along songs. You know, as opposed to the really long jam band, acid trippy kind of stuff that they would do. But here they were, two songs into the second set, and they had already been on stage for over 45 minutes. And, you know, then the next thought is, oh, maybe this is going to be one of those nights where they only play like 5 second set songs. But they came out and they played a few more, and it was wonderful. They went into a song, The Howling, which I hadn't heard before, and had a great moment where all the fans in the crowd started howling back at them, and almost so loud that they were overpowering the band sound. And instead of fighting back, the band just kind of slipped into a nice little groove that played in right with what the crowd was doing. Trey was having a good time and smiling. Mike Gordon was having a good time and smiling. Fish is back there just doing his thing like he always does. And Paige, man, he's just tearing up those keyboards. What a talent he is, and how amazing that is. And so they went from the Holly into a Wave of Hope. Into Lifeboy, a three song slot there that none of those were Fish songs that I knew very well, or was able to recognize on my own without a little help from the crowd I was with, Matthew and the boys, who know everything, but they were all fun. They were really, really great. And then they immediately slipped into Sand, which I recognize very well. And Sand is a tune that I'm kind of having a little bit of a love affair with. It's a great jamming tune, the silly lyrics and all of that. And it's just something that's fun for me, because I know it well, and I'm ready to be able to jam right along with them. And they extended that one out a few minutes. So it came in at about 15 minutes or so, and really just a lot of fun. And then they closed off the set with Golgi Apparatus, which is the oldest song that Trey wrote with a bunch of his high school buddies back in high school. And if you ever took, I don't know if it's biology or whatever, you study the Golgi Apparatus, and I can't even remember what it was, but we all remember laughing at the name when we were in high school. It's just like a quick little Fish, I don't want to say throwaway song, because they clearly like it, but just kind of one they drop in there at the end of a set sometimes. And they play it well, and the crowd reacts to it, because it's so well known and such a part of the band's history and their songbook and all of that. And so it was fun, and they gave us just about another 90 minute set of great, tremendous music. And the fact that 40 of the 90 minutes were taken up with Simple, kind of made it cool. And everybody was really jamming on it, and they really nailed it. They came back out for the encore just a couple of minutes later and opened with Esther, a song that I do know. Can't tell you that it's one of my favorites. It's kind of a happy, silly song, and they enjoy playing it. And then they jumped into Character Zero, which is a very, very good song. I think it's got great rock and roll chords on it. It's got great lyrics. It's got a lot of energy. And it's probably the song I've heard more than any other Fish song from all the shows I go to. It's like I catch all the Character Zeros. But now I can say, well, maybe that's the last one for the next couple of nights. And, I won't be catching it every third show or something like that. It's not a terrible song to catch every third show, but there's still enough Fish tunes out there that I'm chasing that I haven't caught yet. That you feel like you'd like to hear one of them every now and then as well. But no complaints, a great show. Everyone had a ball. Jason enjoyed it and was psyched that he got to catch a show while he was in the States. The whole crowd of Matthew's buddies were really whooping it up and enjoying it very much. Jonathan liked it. I liked it. We all made our way out of there, and walking up that hill, which is so steep, much steeper than I always remember it being. And, after standing on the hill downhill all night, it gives us a good little bit of exercise at the end of the evening. Got in the car and hopped out as fast as we could, given the fact that they had screwed us all in the no VIP exits. But we did make it out. And all in all, folks, it was a wonderful, wonderful two nights of Fish at a legendary venue. And I'm very excited, because I'm getting picked up in about 2 hours from now when I'm taping the show. And I'm heading back up there for night three and all the action that goes along with it. The other music news that I do want to mention today that I think is really, really important is we recently lost John Mayall. He's known as the godfather of the British blues. He had a band called Blues Breakers. I had never heard of him till good buddy Mikey turned me on to him and bought one of his albums and just listened to it over and over and over and over again, because it's a great songs, great music, great people playing with him, and you'll hear about this. Some of the people he played was incredible. But he died 1 week ago. He was 90 years old. Among fans and organizations posting condolences was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is inducting him into its ranks this October. The Hall's committee had selected him this year to be ushered in under the Musical Influence Award, along with Alex Korner and Big Mama Thornton. No cause of death was given, although it did refer to Mayall's recent health setbacks, and announced that he did pass away at his home, surrounded by his loving family, and that they just basically said that health issues had forced John to end his epic touring career have finally led to peace for one of this world's greatest road warriors. Mayall, whose keening jazz-inflected tenor vocals reflected the heavy influence of the American singer Mos Allison, fronted his group, known variously as Blues Breakers, or two words, or Blues Breakers, one word, in its earlier incarnation, on keyboard, harmonic, and occasional guitar, and penned dozens of original songs. Among the players he brought into his bands were such legends, and listen to this group, Eric Clapton, Peter Green of Fleetwood Mac, Mick Taylor of the Rolling Stones, Jack Bruce, John McVie of Fleetwood Mac, Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac, and legendary drummer Ainsley Dunbar. He was perhaps best known in America for the song Room to Move, a staple on FM radio in the early 1970s. That was the song Mayall ultimately chose to end his touring career with. At the close of his final concert, which took place on March 26, 2022, at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano, California, many of the blues masters who paved the way for Mayall, offered him praise for his keeping the genre in the limelight. John Mayall, he was the master of it, said B.B. King, saying that if it weren't for him and other blues musicians of his prime era putting their own spin on the blues, a lot of us black musicians in America would still be catching the hell we caught long before. Musicians attested to what it meant to play for Mayall. As far as being a blues guitarist sideman, the Blues Breakers gig is the pinnacle. That's Mount Everest, said Walter Trout. You can play with B.B. King or Buddy Guy, but you're just going to play chords all night. This song features you. You get to play solos. He yells your name after every song, brings you to the front of the stage, and lets you sing. He creates a place for you in the world. Just so much talent. And when you see that and how wonderful, and then where all of this goes, when Clapton exited Blues Breakers, he went on to found the rock supergroup Cream with bassist Jack Bruce, who had also been playing with him, with Mayall, along with drummer Ginger Baker. And like we said, when Peter Green dropped out, he formed Fleetwood Mac with Mick Fleetwood and John McVie. And on Mayall's recommendation, Teenage Phenom, Taylor wound up replacing Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. So, if you were a young musician and you were trying to make your way, get your chops, and establish a name for yourself, John Mayall was a good guy to hook up with. And I'm sure we don't have enough time to really feature some of his music today, and maybe we will somewhere down the road, because it's just so exceptional. There's so many great obits that have been written about him that you can find on the internet. And each one of them, they all cover a lot of the same things, but each one of them brings in a new story and a different story about him that's just really, really cool and fun to see. And it's a shame, like I say, as we lose rock and roll legends. But condolences to John's family, to the musical world that all knew him and loved him, to all the guys that, got to get their lucky breaks and play with him and learn and grow from him and be launched into rock and roll stardom. And these are just amazing stories. When you hear these names and the people that he was involved with, there's not a lot of folks like him left. So we really have to cherish the moments that we have with him and take the time to really appreciate them. Speaking of appreciating the moments, we're going to go back to 30 years ago today to Buckeye Lake, Ohio. And towards the end of the first set, we're going to play the very, very, very tail end of Althea into one of the new tunes.
Looking at me.
It's a funny story, and there's a bunch of funny stories attached to this. Eternity was one of the new tunes, Bobby new tune, that was never particularly well received by the Deadheads. You know, he'd play it, we'd all kind of roll along with it. But the reason why I tagged on the very end of Althea clip there is because you could hear as they're transitioning, the Dead, I don't know what year they started doing it, but they were one of the first bands I saw that had this onstage communication system where they could step on a pedal on stage and speak into the microphone, and everybody else, the guys on the stage, could hear it through their little earpieces. So if they wanted to talk about what song to play or this or that, but every now and then they'd make a mistake and they'd forget to step on the pedal, and you could hear Bobby throwing out, suggesting, should we go into Eternity? And the crowd's all yelling, no, no, no. You know, because it just wasn't one of the favorites, but they play it anyway. And, you know, once they start playing it, everybody settles down and really has a good time with it. Now, this was interesting because Bobby kind of co-wrote this song with Willie Dixon. So he says it was like a dream come true. Dixon was one of the preeminent blues songwriters and performers. We've talked about all the songs the Dead covered of his, including Down at the Bottom, I Ain't Superstitious, I Just Want to Make Love to You, Little Red Rooster, The Same Thing, Spoonful, Wang Dang Doodle. You know, just he could have been considered another member of the Dead or a number writer for the Dead, just given how many of their songs that they played. So Bobby said that he says, I had this chord progression and melody that I wanted to run by Willie to see if he liked it. He did, so he started dashing off words. He wanted me to run a certain section by him again and stuff like that, and we started working on a bridge. Then he dashes off this sheet of lyrics and hands it to me. Now, I'm really stoked to be working with the legendary Willie Dixon, and I'm prepared for just about anything. He hands me these lyrics, and I'm reading through them, and they seem, you know, awfully simplistic, like there wasn't a whole lot to them. Now, he wants me to read through it and sing the melody I have and see if they fit. And so I started singing through these simplistic lyrics, and that simplicity takes on a whole other direction. By the time I had sung through them, it's like my head is suddenly eons wide. I can hear what's happening just sort of echoing around in there, and I'm astounded by the simple grace of what he has just presented to me. I'm sitting there with my mouth open, literally, and Willie's laughing. He's just sitting there laughing and saying, now you see it, now you see it. That's the wisdom of the blues. Great story. Still not one of our favorite songs, but worth just for, you know, for that little moment of honesty from the Deadheads. And you know, Bobby saying, well, I hear you, but that's okay, it's my tune, I'm gonna play it anyway. And he did wind up playing it 44 times, first on February 21st, 1993, at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum in Oakland, and then right up to the very end, July 8th, 1995, at Soldier Field in Chicago was the last time it was played. And you know, what's interesting about this is when you see the Dead in various stages, you know, as the Dead on the 50th anniversary shows, or, you know, as Dead and Company, they cover a lot of Jerry tunes, a lot of Jerry New tunes. You know, I've talked about how, like, they cover Liberty, which isn't one of my favorite tunes, but they never cover any of these Bobby tunes. I don't think I've heard any of these groups play Eternity once. I'm not saying they haven't, but if they do, it's very, very rare. And, you know, people can just take what they want away from that. But, you know, any song that the Dead wrote and played, I always gave them credit for and was always happy to hear them play it, just as I was always happy to hear them. Now we're going to jump in here to another song. And the set close out with Althea, Eternity, and then Deal. Then they come out and they open up the second set with Foolish Heart, another new tune. And then, lo and behold, they drop into this.
Foolish is filled with things to say.
I Want to Tell You is a song by the English rock band The Beatles from their 1966 album Revolver. It was written and sung by George Harrison, the band's lead guitarist, after Taxman and Love You Too. It was the third Harrison composition recorded for Revolver. Its inclusion on the LP marked the first time he was allocated more than two songs on a Beatles album, a reflection of his continued growth as a songwriter besides John Lennon and Paul McCartney. When writing I Want to Tell You, Harrison drew inspiration from his experimentation with LSD. The lyrics addressed what he later termed the avalanche of thoughts that are so hard to write down or say or transmit. In combination with the song's philosophical message, Harrison's stuttering guitar riff and the dissonance he employs in the melody reflect the difficulties of achieving meaningful communication. The recording marked the first time that McCartney played his bass guitar part after the band had completed the rhythm track for a song, a technique that became commonplace on the Beatles' subsequent recordings. Harrison wrote, I Want to Tell You, in the early part of 1966, the year in which his songwriting matured in terms of subject matter and productivity. As a secondary composer to Lennon and McCartney and the Beatles, he began to establish his own musical identity through his absorption in Indian culture, as well as the perspective gained again through his experience with LSD. According to the author Gary Tillery, the song resulted from a creative surge that Harrison experienced at the start of 1966. In his autobiography, I Mean Mine, Harrison says that I Want to Tell You addresses the avalanche of thoughts that are so hard to write down. Author Russell Riesing and Jim LeBlanc cite the song along with Rain and Within You, Without You as early examples of the Beatles abandoning coy statements about their lyrics and instead adopting an urgent tone and intent on channeling some essential knowledge, the psychological and or philosophical epiphanies of the LSD experience. So, you know, we got a lot of drugs going on here with the boys. We got a lot of experimentation going on with the Beatles. And once again, you have the Grateful Dead just loving it, right? And just jamming into another Beatles song. And I can't tell you if I remember another song where they played two Beatles tunes in one show. They may very well have, but I can't recall it. And, you know, that's just a treat. Whenever they would play the Beatles, it didn't matter which song it was always a lot of fun. I love Jerry singing it. Again, his voice is not very strong on it, but I give him credit. He's up there singing it, and, you know, they're trying the harmonies out and everything. And, you know, this is the second to last year of the band. And again, I think they're just looking for some fun things to do. I think a lot of this is Vince Welnick influenced. They only played it seven times, the first on July 1st, 1994 at Shoreline, and then the final time on May 24th, 1995 at Memorial Stadium in Seattle, Washington. So not a song that got a lot of playtime, but when it did, it was very much appreciated by the crowd. And I just always found that the boys were having a fun time and a fun night and, you know, getting a little silly and just, you know, breaking out some of the music that they love. And as a Deadhead, you know, you can't ask for anything more than that. You know, we love all sorts of songs, but hey, guys, play us the music you love to play. And when they do it, everyone just has a great, great time. So now we're going to dive into some marijuana talk here. And Dan has some good music for that as well. Dan drilling deep again. Along comes Mary, a song composed by Tandon Elmer, originally recorded by American sunshine pop band The Association. It was the group's first hit, released in March 1966 as the lead single prior to their debut album. And then along comes The Association, which appeared that July. The song is sung from the point of view of a once disillusioned young man talking about the tribulations no one ever sees and who curses those faults in me. The singer believes Mary gives him comfort and improves his life. Both Leonard Bernstein and Tandon Elmer stated that Mary was a reference to marijuana. This association was also prevalent among many of the song's listeners. In the Young People's Concert titled What is a Mode, Leonard Bernstein explained that the song was composed in the Dorian mode. The Association is an American sunshine pop band from California, L.A. During the late 1960s, the band had numerous hits at or near the Billboard charts, including Windy, Cherish, Never My Love, Along Comes Mary, and they were the leadoff band at 1967's Monterey Pop Festival. Generally consisting of 6 to 8 members, they're known for intricate vocal harmonies by the band's multiple singers. For us, it's just a fun song that demonstrates how well the musical culture was in line with marijuana back at the time and how much they like to work it into their songs, sometimes in ways that were not necessarily obvious to the Straits, but the Stoners certainly all got it. And with that, we're going to dive into marijuana, and this time we're going to start on the bad news side because it's always better to end on the good news side. And we have our friends over there in the GOP just giving us a hard freaking time. Thank you to Marijuana Moment. Says we have 2 more congressional lawmakers are joining the ranks of GOP members who are challenging what they say is the unusual process that led the Biden administration to propose rescheduling marijuana, expressing concern about how the review was carried out and demanding answers. In a letter sent to Attorney General Merrick Garland and Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra on Thursday, House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican from Washington State, and Subcommittee on Health Chair Brett Guthrie, a Republican from Kentucky, said the circumstances surrounding this proposed rule are unusual, and we are concerned by the process that led to this determination. The lawmakers pointed out that prior cannabis scheduling reviews concluded with denials following rigorous analysis of its medical value and abuse potential, and they questioned why Health and Human Services adopted a different review standard for cannabis this round, moving from a 5-factor analysis to a 2-factor analysis. While the administration is empowered to alter drug scheduling statuses, and Health and Human Services did still account for various scientific considerations in its latest review, the two congresspeople say, we believe there are several unanswered questions and policy gaps, and that we want to have those addressed. After Health and Human Services recommended moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 of the Controlled Substances Act, the Justice Department declared that this new 2-part test is sufficient to establish medical use, which is an unusual deviation from the typical process, the letter says, adding that they found it further suspect that the DEA itself indicated that it felt more information was needed before it could accept this rescheduling determination. While moving cannabis to Schedule 3 would not federally legalize it, the lawmakers said such a policy would change other state policy and cause more confusion because it's unclear how the federal government would regulate a Schedule 3 substance, which, as we've said, should only be dispensed with a valid description. And there are only 24 states that have legalized recreational use for marijuana. And they also note that the Office of National Drug Control Policy and some DEA administrators have pushed back against cannabis rescheduling. They say, we support research into innovative therapies to improve patient outcomes, but we are concerned with how the normal process was circumvented to achieve a result for political purposes, and we have a number of unanswered questions, McMorris, Rogers, and Guthrie said, including the list of specific questions they are asking DOJ and HHS to respond to in a timely manner. Worst of all, when determining whether marijuana has a medical use, HHS used their own 2-factor analysis instead of a 5-star. Please provide an example of this method and why. Do DOJ and HHS believe the new 2-factor test is appropriate? If it's moved to Schedule 3, it's our understanding can only be dispensed by valid prescription and that recreational use would continue to be out of compliance with federal law. So some of these questions aren't crazy. And I appreciate the fact that they've zeroed in on this thing that we've been talking about Schedule 3, how that's not really helping anybody because it's still federally illegal and it can only be dispensed by a pharmacist with a properly written prescription, which no state has these days. But it's this idea of whether it's safe and whether we should really be going ahead with this type of thing, and just how safe it is. Then we get Senator Doug LaMalfa, a Republican from California, condemning the Biden administration's push to reclassify marijuana, as well as legislative efforts to enact bipartisan cannabis banking reform, because he says the policy changes would prop up this immoral industry and give a green light to the evil that comes from drug use. Not to be outdone, Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, also had blasted the Biden administration over what he describes as repeated refusals from federal agencies to brief Congress on its plans and justifications for rescheduling marijuana, which he argues fuels speculation that the proposed policy change is politically motivated. They said that the government's recommendations are based on politics rather than science. Folks, these are just people who have their heads really, really far up their ass. And I'm sorry to say that there's just no other way to say it. This immoral industry. You know, Doug, how many drinks do you have every night before you go to bed? Doug, what do you think about, all of these codeine type drugs and Oxycontin and all this stuff that's been coming out? Probably a lot of your big donors, certainly big donors to the Republican Party, are drug manufacturers that have sold those drugs. And we see what they're doing to society. We see the devastation that they've created in this country. I don't see you calling that an immoral industry. I don't see you calling alcohol an immoral industry. I don't see you calling cigarettes an immoral industry. I don't see you calling caffeine an immoral industry. All of those substances are shown to be more harmful to the human body than THC. So why do we have to sit here and say the THC is so bad? Well, nobody knows. Nobody can really say. In a companion story, this time Marijuana Moment focuses entirely on the GOP talking about this immoral industry. And we already quoted Representative LaMalfa the issues he brings to the table. And LaMalfa goes on to say, if enacted, this would increase the use of an already dangerous substance, while rescheduling would allow licensed cannabis businesses to take federal tax deductions. We've talked about that, getting rid of 280E and what a benefit it is. It also removes certain research barriers. It would not legalize the plant. So it's unclear what he means by suggesting it would increase usage rates. It's already being used by so many people. LaMalfa also claimed, contrary to prior research, that California has the highest rate of marijuana users. If he meant number of consumers, that might be explained by the fact that the state has the greatest population in the nation. But in terms of rates of consumption, surveys have consistently found higher percentage of uses in other states. In any case, he said, it's no surprise that California also has the highest rate of welfare recipients, which is also not true on a per capita basis. That title belongs to New Mexico, followed by Louisiana, West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Oregon, if assessed based on federal SNAP benefits. So not only is he lying, but he's trying to create the idea that people who smoke marijuana wind up on welfare. And he says the government should disincentivize the use of this harmful drug and not allow banks to prop up this immoral industry. The federal government should have no role in encouraging citizens to break federal laws, by incentivizing the banks to go ahead and do it. So he's saying, nope, we should still keep the banks in the dark. We should still make this difficult for everyone. He says they all become addicts. They rely on state welfare, disability payments for unemployment. Their medical problems will increase and drain our already strained healthcare system, which taxpayers, are not going to front the bill for that. Boy, what a wonderful statement to unpack. There are no addicts. They don't rely on state welfare. Disability payments for unemployment, we see, does not happen in marijuana. Medical problems, we've already read studies that show that in states with legalized marijuana, communities with legalized marijuana, that the overall cost of healthcare goes down, not up. This guy's talking out of his ass. He's saying things he doesn't know what he means. He's just anti-marijuana, and he's getting up there, and he's sounding as best he can like Reefer Madness without coming quite out and saying it. But anybody who talks about this being an immoral industry, anybody who talks about all the drug addicts and the drain it's going to create on society, hasn't really been paying attention the last 50 years, hasn't really been paying attention to what's going on in this country. Because, again, study after study shows that marijuana does not make people less motivated. It doesn't stop them from going out and getting jobs. on this show, on this podcast, we have gone through so many different studies that outline all of this, that we know, our listeners know, that when you hear somebody like this, the bullshit meter can't hit maximum fast enough. It just can't, because the question is, why do you do this, Mr. Republican Congress people or Ms. Republican Congress people? You know that people in your state love to smoke marijuana. For God's sakes, in California, it's the backbone of that state in so many regards. It's not being run really well right now, but that's because you got these politicians, you know, who are playing all sorts of stupid games with it. But you can't be from California and honestly say with a straight face that it's immoral, that it causes all of this unemployment and all of these strains on society. It's just not true. And you'll note that when the people make these statements, they never cite any studies anywhere. They just say it as a patronizing, condescending government person who's sure that they know better than everybody else. And again, even though the majority of the people in our state like marijuana, I'm here to tell you that it's immoral and it causes bad things for people and we shouldn't have it legalized. Fuck you. I'm sorry. That's all we can say about that is fuck you. We can't spend any more time on it because these people just are fucked. But if we move on, we see the NCAA has voted to remove marijuana from banned substances list for college athletes. We've talked about this story before, and it's a great story to talk about because in the context of all of this that's going on, we have the NCAA, which is usually pretty strict about these kind of things, and they have come out and they said that it does not provide a competitive advantage. The council focuses on policies centered on student-athlete health and well-being rather than punishment for cannabis use. This is refreshing to hear from the NCAA, which is a pretty draconian organization in and of itself when it comes to their rules and what they do. And so even though we've talked about this particular story before, it's worth talking about right now because it's such a alternate view. It's such a more realistic view than what we're seeing from our own government. And you know, we have the NCAA, like we say, who's very strict about things, and even they've gotten on board with this. And that's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to see, and something that everybody should know about. And here's another one for Mr. LaMalfa and his motley crew of folks who want to sit there and tell us why marijuana is no good. A new study suggests that access to medical marijuana may increase the amount of parenting that people engage in by improving patients' health. Medical marijuana legalization reduces inactive time and increases sleep, consistent with medical marijuana's health benefits, the report published this month in the Journal of Applied Economics says. Our results suggest that medical marijuana can have significant positive impact on the development of children via increased parenting time, the study concludes, especially to those under the age of 6, a period characterized by high long-run returns to parental investment. The big caveat in the findings, research notes, is that the benefits apply only if the parents do not misuse cannabis, noting bigger increases in parenting time for those less likely to abuse marijuana. Marijuana can produce health benefits for those suffering from chronic pain, sleep disorder, depression, and PTSD, allowing parents to better interact with their children, the report says. So the report was co-authored by Cynthia Bancic of the St. Lawrence University Economics Department and Yoon Young Kim of the School of Digital Humanities and Computational Social Sciences at South Korea's Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. Both authors also represent the Institute of Labor Economics in Bonn, Germany, and the Global Labor Organization in Essen, Germany. We show that legalization of medical marijuana increases parenting time with children, they wrote. The increases are significant in active child care activities that require less effort of the parents, such as playing with the child, and on passive child care in which parents watch over children while engaging in some other activity. Looking at the heterogeneous effects of the effects are greater for those who are more likely to benefit from the medical use of marijuana, and for subsamples with larger baseline parenting time, such parents who have children younger than 6. The treatment effectively corresponds to 8% to 12% of the gap in parental time on childcare between parents with some college education and less college education. So, and the story goes on, and again, you know, these people are not talking out of their ass. These people have actually conducted studies. They're providing scientific study results. So, you know, LaMalfa can go on and scream to the heavens all he wants about how bad this is, but he's just talking out of his ass. He doesn't address these studies. He doesn't say why these studies are wrong. He doesn't say why study after study after study that we see points out the helpful benefits of it for veterans, for people with disabilities, for people who are on opioids and don't want to be on opioids, for people who are on any kind of medication out there where marijuana has shown to have a positive impact. And we can just go through all of them again and again and again. And what they all point out more than anything else is the positive benefits. And here, just like as an example, and without even having to go through all the particular details, we have just a whole line of stories. We're talking about positive impact on children. Lesser known marijuana components can be promising anti-cancer agents. So, say study on multiple myeloma finds. More Americans smoke marijuana every day than drink alcohol on a daily basis, a new poll shows. The California State Fair will allow marijuana sales and on-state consumption for the first time. Right, just over and over and over, we're seeing positive stories that come out of marijuana. Think about it. There's lesser known marijuana components can be promising anti-cancer agents. Mr. LaMalfa, how is this a problem? All of you people out there telling us that it's dangerous, that it's harmful, that it's immoral. All you have to do is turn on your computer. All you have to do is Google marijuana, and the stories are here. Now, you can choose not to believe any of them, but if you really don't want to believe them, you have to go out and you have to sponsor studies of your own. And then in those studies of your own that you're going to sponsor, then if you want, you can come back, assuming the results are going to bear out what you're trying to say to us. But knowing that the results aren't going to bear out what you're trying to say to us, I think that you have to be a little more realistic, and you have to be honest with the people who you represent, and you have to be honest with the American public as a whole. And until you're willing to do that, you need to just shut up on this, because you're just wasting everybody's time. And so look at the positive stories, folks out there. Keep a positive attitude about this. Don't be bummed out by these people on the right who are the moral police and think that they're going to come in and tell us how we should live our lives just because they keep their neckties a little too tight, because they keep their asses a little too pinched, because they're just not ready to relax and enjoy life and have fun. And nothing's more important to them than making sure that everybody else doesn't do the things that they say we shouldn't be doing. And it's a shame. And we're going to reach a point very soon, I think, where these folks won't even have a chance anymore, because so many people will be smoking marijuana. It will be so prevalent. It will be in so many available states. And more and more and more of these studies are going to come out, and it's going to be a benefit for society. And hopefully a few years from now, people will be looking back on these folks and laughing the way we look back on the crazy folks, right, of the 30s and 40s and reefer madness era and all of that, because it's just, you know, human mentality that sometimes can't let go. And the only way, good thing to how to let go of human mentality is to get high. But if you won't get high in the first place, you're in a catch 22, folks. Good. Live in your catch 22 when it comes to marijuana. Just please shut the fuck up about it. Nobody wants to hear from you anymore. But we do want to hear more from the Grateful Dead, and we are going back to 30 years ago today. Buckeye Lake, Ohio. Now we go deep into the second set, and Jerry pops out and plays this tune, which we call a new tune, but certainly wasn't a new tune by this point.
Standing on the moon, where talk is cheap and vision true. Standing on the moon, but I would rather be with you. Somewhere in San Francisco, on a back porch.
Standing on the Moon, a beautiful Garcia Hunter tune from the Built to Last album that came out in 1989. You know, Jerry's voice is a little bit tired here, but it's still, you know, strong, and he's around the edges. It's lacking a little, but I just love the determination with which he plays that song. It's really, really a beautiful tune. Too bad it came so late in the day, but not that late. They played it 76 times, the first on February 5th, 1989 at Henry J. Kaiser in Oakland, and the last time was on June 30th, 95 at Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Great tune. Download the show, listen to the whole thing. We're getting to the end. I got to get ready because I'm getting picked up to head back up to Alpine Valley soon, and there's a lot going up there that I got to get ready for. A couple of little things here at the end of today's show. I have some shout outs. We have some birthdays coming up in the next few days that I want to make sure that I get to and give proper credit. On July 30th, a busy day for me. My lovely niece Samantha is having a birthday, and my good buddy Mikey took me to my first Dead show. Great guy. Love having him around. And always it's his birthday. And he and his partner Lynn are up in the great north woods of Canada this weekend. Lynn's daughter is getting married, and mazel tov to them. I've seen some pictures. It's just beautiful up there. And very, very exciting for them and the new couple. And then, of course, on August 1st, who could forget? It's Jerry's birthday. So we don't have a show on August 1st this year. But we will be talking about that next week, because we will be dab smack in the middle of the Days Between, of course, which is everything about Jerry, and all good for that. So just wanted to get those birthday shout outs out there. We'll have more to talk about next week. I'll have the Sunday Night Fish Show from Alpine, the two fish shows from St. Louis. And although I will not have been at the three fish shows from Deer Creek, those will have been played as well. So we can check the notes and see what went on down there. Just check in with our buddy Joel from Ripple Tax in Chicago. Joel's the man for tax, but he's also the man for great live music, and he's doing the whole damn tour, and I'm so jealous of him that I can't believe it. But good for him, good for everybody, and it's really great. We're going out today with Quinn the Eskimo, the Mighty Quinn. It's a folk song written and first recorded by Bob Dylan in 1967 during the Basement Tape sessions. The song's first release was in January 1968 as Mighty Quinn in a version by the British band Manfred Mann, which became a great success. It was recorded by a number of other performers, often under the title The Mighty Quinn. The song is the subject of the song is the arrival of Quinn, an Eskimo who prefers a more relaxed lifestyle, jumping queues and making haste just ain't my cup of meat, refuses hard work, just tell me where to put him and I'll tell you who to call, but brings joy to the people. Dylan is widely believed to have derived the title character from actor Anthony Quinn's role as an Eskimo in the 1960 movie The Savage Innocence. Dylan has also been quoted as saying that the song was nothing more than a simple nursery rhyme. A 2004 Chicago Tribune article said the song was named after Gordon Quinn, co-founder of Cart McKean Films, who had given Dylan and Howard Alk uncredited assistance on Eat the Document. Dylan's first recorded the song in 1967, as we said, during the Basement Tapes, but didn't release it for another three more years until after Manfred Mann's single had been released. Many of us know the song first by way of Manfred Mann, like Blinded for the Light. But of course, it's a Dylan tune at its heart, not Blinded by the Light. That's a Springsteen tune. But Quinn the Eskimo was almost always played as an encore. Fish plays it as an encore. It's just kind of a funky tune. The Dead played it 59 times. They first played it on December 30th, 1985 at Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. They played it for the last time on July 2nd, 1995 at Deer Creek. So as I leave you today, we're going to leave you with, from 30 years ago today, Quinn the Eskimo by the Grateful Dead. Have a great week, everyone. Stay safe. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks for listening.